Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here tonight with Bruce McCurdy. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, David. How are you doing tonight?
Just fine. Bruce, how are you doing?
All right. All things considered.
Yeah. Season's winding down. Season's winding down. And the Edmonton Oilers lose in overtime to the Arizona Coyotes.
Hungry pack of Coyotes.
Yeah. We're going to be apparently, that franchise looks like it's moving to Utah this year, Bruce. I have to say, when I saw that news, I just thought, you have it coming. I've got a long memory. And I know some people, I guess, are mourning this for some reason. Like, maybe if you're Louis DeBrusque and you played in Arizona. They stole their team from Winnipeg, so I've got no sympathy for them.
They were in Arizona longer than they were in Winnipeg. I mean, even including the WHA years, I think they were longer in Arizona than Winnipeg. But
they were always usurpers to me, Bruce.
And they were always they've always been a drain on the league in terms of hitting up for the equalization fund. And now somehow their owner that's come in and run the crap show for the last few years is going to walk away with a tidy $600 million profit.
Indeed. Bruce, this is our two good things, two bad things, two numbers in one conundrum podcast about tonight's game, which the Oilers lost in overtime. The grade A shots were 17 for the Coyotes, 17 to 13, and the subset of five alarms were 7 to 6 for the Coyotes. They were the better team by that metric and the better team on the scoreboard. Bruce, what's your good thing?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. Oilers had the more shots in this game, but I'm not surprised at all that it added up at the end to be more dangerous shots by Arizona. My good thing is I'm going to go with Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. I thought he had a strong game tonight. Absolutely nothing to show for it. Offensively, just 0-0 across the board. But he led the team with in ice time, 21 minutes, 41 seconds, a bit more than we would like to see, I think. Led the team in ice time in both power play and shorthanded, which the penalty kill team was good. The power play had one whole opportunity in the game and weren't able to connect. And the PK had two times to kill, and they did a good job, I thought, on the penalty kill. And even strength, I thought Nuge was bringing it. He had 6 shots on net, 9 shot attempts, had a couple hits, 3 takeaways. Like, he was all over the puck. And there was one sequence in particular in the third period where he made a great play in his own end of the ice to end a cycle and get puck going in the right direction. Then he charged up to join the rush Leon fed Hyman for a chance, and then Nuge almost cashed the rebound. And then the puck came squirting out of the zone the other way, and who's out in the neutral zone breaking up the attack before it gets anywhere? Nugent Hopkins, same sequence. Good play in the D zone, the O zone, and the neutral zone, right in a row. And so that caught my eye on a night that a lot of Oilers really didn't.
Yeah. I like Nugent Hopkins and Draisaitl together. I think that's an interesting combination. And we'll see when McDavid gets back if maybe they stick with that, because those guys are working fairly well together at even strength. That line did create a number of grade A shots at even strength, even though they didn't score. So, Bruce, my good thing was this line struggled at times defensively. The line of Evander Kane, Adam Henrique, and Warren Fogle. But they had two sequences, one in the first period and then one in the second period where they scored a goal. And in the first period, it was the Oilers' first grade A shot on net. It was a face-off play And Henrique won the face-off. I think it was pass over. Either Kulak or Stetcher to Desharnais, who put it deep. And then Fogel centered the puck to Evander Kane, who had two incredible chances in the first period in this sequence. Bang, bang. I think they both, one hit the post, one hit the crossbar. And that was nice. And then early in the second period, with the Oilers down 1-0, they tied the game. And this was Evander Kane making a nice play, winning the puck, getting the puck, making a nice backhand, hard backhander on net. And Henrique putting in the rebound. Just a excellent play. Actually, there was initially a slot shot from Henrique, and then Kane won it. And then that's when he put it on net and Henrique put it in. So in that sequence, Henrique had two grade A shots, two five alarm shots in that same sequence. So that line was looking good at that moment, Bruce. I thought they might be my good thing for the game. And mm-hmm. It's an interesting line. I think it's a possibility. Henrique isn't the fastest player, so he needs to play with fast players. And Fogel is that. And Kane is not slow. He can be fast. He's fast going forward. We'll say that diplomatically. And so it's, you know, it's got some power. It's got some skill. And Henrique wasn't his best game, that's for sure. But he can, I think, play smart defensive hockey. He's cut out, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But that line is a possibility, like in terms of what they might do. Of course, when McDavid comes back, they're going to have to slide out one player from the top six. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that could be Kane. It could be Henrique. We'll see who gets put on the third line. But, yeah, the Oilers, I mean, there's some interest, you know, McDavid being out two games here. They've gotten 3 points out of the two games. They've tried some different line combinations that I think have been kind of interesting, both this one and the Draisaitl line. So hasn't been a total disaster.
Nope, not total.
What's your bad thing, Bruce?
Yeah, well, it's basically coverage by the forwards on the rush. The first two regulation goals by Arizona both came off of 3-on-2 rushes, where the two D-men were left to their own devices by the three forwards. Now, in the first one, one of those D-men, Evan Bouchard, did not help his own cause by directly passing the puck to Arizona with a breakout pass that I don't know who it was intended to, but it went right to the Arizona guy and came just sort of like it hit a backboard, came right back through the neutral zone, and all three Oilers forwards were trapped. And one of them, Dylan Holloway, came back hard, but didn't know what to do, frankly. Like, he had a guy to pick up there in the slot, and instead he sort of got into puck watching, and he skated too deep, and the puck bounced to the guy that he, well, could have been covering, and he, you know, he went down, tried to block the shot. Well, that didn't help. I mean, he tried, but it didn't end well. And it was just a case of Oilers being outnumbered. And then the second goal was the same thing. Like, there was a battle along the wall, and this was the Fogel Henry Kane line. Kane went down low below the goal line. I don't think he did a thing wrong. And Fogel got into a one-on-one battle on the wall, and Henrique went up the boards behind him towards the icing line. And when Fogel lost the battle, there was no forwards left, and it was just a wide open 3-on-2 from like the hash marks in Arizona's territory. By the time they hit the blue line, David, all three of those Arizona forwards were hitting the blue line, and there was no Oilers forward even at center. That's how wide open the 3-on-2 was. And even at that, their D-man, Durzi, who had a good game, he activated, and he took a pass, and it was his shot that was kind of ping-ponged around, and, you know, the rebound was wrapped out of the air. And you can say that it was, you know, the D-men didn't do their job, but for sure the forwards didn't do their job. And I would, on that particular play, single out Adam Henrique for being in the wrong spot. The puck support play there for a safe, conscientious defense first team like the Oilers are trying to be is above the puck. And he was below the puck.
Yeah.
The puck went south and he never caught up.
When you're playing the center position, you want to play it like the 34-year-old Sam Gagne, not the 20-year-old Sam Gagne.
Right.
And Henrique played that as a 20-year-old. Sam Gagne was on the wrong side of the scrum almost every single time, hoping the puck would squirt loose so he could get it and charge on net with the puck. It was just again and again and again. But in the second incarnation, or this third that we've seen of Gagne with the Oilers, he's on the right side of the puck almost always. So he's as you say, behind the puck. So if Warren Fogle loses the puck, as is going to happen to players in board battles, you're there to stop it. And Henrique just skated on by and was on the wrong side of the puck. And so for a smart veteran player, that didn't come close to meeting the standard. The Holloway mistake was more like, again, a 20-year-old Sam Gagne.
But it was a 20-year-old mistake.
There was a huge, you know, Holloway had a really good game. In his first game back, he was rushing around doing things, making a lot of noise, scored a goal, big hit. And, you know, there's a lot of people who really, really like this player and think he should be playing in the lineup, maybe even higher up the lineup. And I don't, honestly, Bruce, I don't see it. Like, this kind of mistake, like, all due respect to the player who has tremendous potential and can really fly and make plays, but too many defensive mistakes like this. And until he cuts out this kind of mistake, if he makes that play, like the veteran player, the veteran move is you don't watch the puck. You're looking for the danger man creeping into the slot and you take him.
Right.
And if you do that, there's nothing bad happens. But the young player puck watches, the offensive minded player puck watches. And that's what he did and doesn't take the man. And there's a goal scored because of it in large part. So, there's nothing like Dylan Holloway has all kinds of potential as a hockey player, but if he's not in the lineup on opening day of the playoffs, it will be plays like that that are the reason. Oh, yeah. And that's giving all due respect to the amount of talent that he has as a player and potentially as a player, but I would not be playing him again ahead of Ryan, Janmark, or Brown. And I know some people they'll scream when they hear that. They can't believe anyone would say that. But we break down the grade A shots for and against. We're doing it for a reason. So on the most crucial plays, we know who's doing their job and who isn't doing their job. And I can assure you, Janmark and Brown do their job far more often in the defensive end than Holloway. And on the attack, they're just about as good right now because, again, he doesn't quite connect all the time with his line mates. So and Corey Perry's not coming out of the lineup. Like, you know, I think you could make an argument to put in Holloway over Corey Perry. Like, I wouldn't think that's crazy personally. Although I like Corey Perry as a player as well, but I don't think that's going to happen either.
Yeah, well, if Holloway's to get into the lineup once McDavid is back, to keep him in the lineup, they'll have to bench one of their low forwards. Now, I mean, you could make the case after tonight's game, if you're going to say, well, we're going to dump on Holloway for, you know, poor coverage on the first goal. Well, we can dump on, and already have dump on Henrique for poor coverage on the second goal. And you're about to dump on him for poor coverage on the third goal, I think.
Yeah. And he's not coming out of the lineup.
Yeah, but he's not coming out of the lineup. He's got five goals already. I mean, Dylan Holloway has played 34 games this year, and he's got four goals and one assist. So defensive mistakes sort of stand out. You know, if you're putting the puck in the net regularly, you know, defensive mistakes are, you know, to some degree, they're a cost of doing business that you have to be prepared to pay. But when you don't, anyway, Dylan Holloway, he had six hits in this game, and he was noticeable, but he was most noticeable when he almost got his head taken off in the first period check. That guy's got to learn to protect himself or he's not going to have a long career.
Fair enough. And of course, we're both rooting for him. He wants to do well, but we're just trying to call him.
I don't want to see him get his head taken off.
Yeah, exactly.
So great Scott Young once wrote, "You skate around with your head down, you'll soon wind up with no head at all in this league."
Adam Henrique, I'm not sure that I would pick him in overtime, honestly. It's a skating game.
Odd choice.
It's a skating game. And, I mean, that's when he might even play Dylan Holloway. I mean, that guy flies. And he can defend. It's the defending is a little simpler in some ways because there's three guys out there. All and you just take one of them. Yeah, it's all man-to-man. So, anyway, they went with Henrique. And my bad thing is the entire overtime. Because it starts out with 30 seconds in, a Phoenix rush. And two veteran players, Nurse and Nugent Hopkins, turned a two-on-two into two absolute howlers of scoring chances for Arizona. Mm-hmm. You know, one a pass across, cross-seam pass that Nurse doesn't cut out, and Nugent Hopkins is slow getting to the shooter.
It's beat to the net, yeah.
And then there's a big rebound, and there's a guy left wide open in front of the net. Nurse can't cut out the pass, and Nugent's way out of position. So two five-alarm shots that it could easily have settled the game right there. And two veteran players on a two-on-two, they just didn't get it done. And then another minute later, another veteran player. It's not a very dangerous situation in the Oilers' zone. Matias Maccelli of the Coyotes, he gets the puck high in the offensive zone. And Henrique is just way too much gap. Now he is a center, isolated with a tricky forward, trying to be the defender. So it's a tough position for a centerman, like a forward, to defend a high-octane offensive player. But he didn't come close. He gave Maccelli all the time in the world. Maccelli kind of angled across the top of the slot and shot across his body back the other direction, and it fooled Calvin Pickard, who up until that point, Calvin Pickard had been outstanding that game. I thought he was played a really strong game. That goal was somewhat iffy. We think it's probably we would count it as a grade A shot because it was from the high outer slot, but he had all kinds of time to pick his spot. And you let any kind of like that guy can just put the puck where he wants it, and he certainly did on that goal because Henrique just gave him all the time and space in the world on that shot by NHL standards.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to fill in a little bit of the gaps in there too, David. Let's start with the very beginning of overtime when linesman kicks Draisaitl out of the faceoff dot to start the overtime for what seemed like the 15th time in the game. These linesmen, man, drop the puck. Anyway, so Nuge came in, lost that draw, and that led to those two chances that Arizona had full possession right from the from the drop. Anyway, after the two saves, there was a great chance the other way where Nuge chipped it up the boards to Leon. Looked like he had a partial breakaway, and he kind of held back. And instead of firing a shot on goal, he made a hard pass to Nurse across the face of goal that wound up in the corner. Yet another Oilers odd man rush that wound up without a shot. A real pet peeve of mine. And this one cost him the hockey game. I mean, Leon had the game on a stick there, you know, 40 goal man, shoot it into the damn net, man. You know, like you got a partial breakaway, just take it to the net, shoot. I like your chances. And he looked it off and nothing. So, and he had a pretty good game, you know, but shooting wasn't a big part of it. He only had two shots. So,
Bruce, what's your number?
Oh, yeah, I had a number. You go first.
All right. The Oilers in this game won 36 out of 55 faceoffs. They're absolutely dominant, 65%. Derek Ryan was 8-1. Mm-hmm. Adam Henrique 7-4, and Leon Draisaitl 13-5. And my number is actually fifth, heading into the game at least. The Oilers were fifth overall in faceoff wins in the NHL as a team. 52.8% of their faceoffs they've won. Number one is Pittsburgh at 55.6. So the Oilers are, and in their conference, there's only one team, Bruce, that's better than them, the Dallas Stars at 53.9, who are going to be on the other side of the draw, initially at least. So the Oilers used to be, in the Decade of Darkness, this was a constant drumbeat, constant issue, and even in McDavid's early years. But this year, individually, the Oilers are all, and this is before the game, because the NHL, I don't think, has updated this. Let me just refresh and see if they have updated it by now. I don't think they have.
Still have it.
They take so long to update their numbers after a game. Yeah. It's like they haven't heard of computers.
Well, their face-off win percentage would have gone up.
For a lot of the players.
They wouldn't have caught New Jersey in fourth.
No.
You know, you'd have to, you know, because they're almost 1% behind them.
Yeah. But
still, top five is good.
So Draisaitl is at, on the season, 56.8% for his face-offs. He's always been good. Yep. This year, Connor McDavid's at 51.3, which is really good for him. Ryan McLeod is at 49.9. Nugent Hopkins, 48. Derek Ryan, 54.8. Adam Henrique, as an Oiler, 58.7. And Sam Carrick, 58.4. So this is really, you know, I'm in the camp that says faceoffs are an overrated statistic. There's a lot of focus on them, a lot of discussion about them. I think it's a fact that you can measure it. It's a battle that you can easily measure, so it's measured. So there's a lot of focus on it. Whereas board battles, for instance, they don't. There's no stat like he's won 57% of his board battles. That would be in some ways, it's harder to measure. It's more subjective, so that's why it's not measured by the NHL officially. It would be a more pertinent stat to a player's value. But face-offs are one battle. They're important battles. And the Oilers are really doing well at them this year, which is good news for the team. Your number, Bruce.
I'll go with 102, which is now Oilers points total. And the fact that they gained 1 point tonight has actually sealed home ice advantage in the first round of the playoffs. They needed one more point to get that job done. They also needed 1 point to at least keep their Pacific Division fate in their own hands. They had 1 point to give, and they gave it tonight. But if they can beat Vancouver in overtime and then win out, or simply match Vancouver the rest of the way, they are... they're able to finish first in the Pacific.
Even with that.
Yeah, because they have one more game left than Vancouver, and they have this head-to-head, and they're 3 points back of them. So,
yeah, so the Oilers can get eight more points. They can finish with 110, and Vancouver can finish with, at most, they've got – well, they could finish with it depends. They got to win. They got to beat Vancouver. So that's interesting.
And I think Oilers will have something left in the tank for Vancouver tomorrow night. In tonight's game, I was very concerned it would be a trap game. And I would say that that's exactly what it turned out to be. You know, they turned it up for a while in the game, but they were never got the lead. And, Arizona spent way too much time in Edmonton's end in the first part of the game, and then the last 10 minutes of the third period was like, let's get moving here, and it was just not a game that they were able to finish off.
It's typical Oilers kind of game since their winning streak, since they, you know, poured it on to get back in the season. You know, they have lots of games where they're just playing well enough to hang in there and, you know, eke out a win.
But they win them. Yeah.
Yeah. And they almost eked out a win here. So,
yeah, Bruce, well, I think they're 10-0-2 in their last 12 home games.
Pretty good.
So that's not, since they lost to Calgary on the hockey night in Canada, they beat LA, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Washington, lost in overtime to Colorado. Beat Montreal in overtime, beat Buffalo, LA, Anaheim, Colorado, Vegas, and then lost in overtime tonight. And by big scores, like they have a, you know, they've been outscoring teams by significant margin over that 12 game run. So you take your point and you say maybe that's all we deserve tonight, but at least we've got something. Let's move on.
Bruce, on to the conundrum. And the conundrum tonight is Mark Stone of Las Vegas, WTF. Mm-hmm. What the Friday is going on there, man?
Same as it ever was. Same as it ever was.
Same Bruce, as it ever was. I'm left. I just think this is completely. There's a couple of funny things. I remember when Stone first got out there, there seemed to be this kind of incredible kind of, is naive the right word, response from a lot of NHL writers, like, well, he's got a lacerated spleen. Of course he's out. Like, what are you guys complaining about? Just shut up. Like, man, what's wrong with you? Like, and I thought, really? Seriously? You believe this? This system is set up. This system is absolutely set up to cheat. There's limited transparency, limited accountability. There's no transparency from a fan's point of view. We have no idea right now. There's not one fan on earth who can say with certainty whether he had a miraculously healing, he had a terrible lacerated spleen or not. Nobody knows. Now, do they know at the NHL? If they're not telling their fans, so that's one thing.
Probably not.
Do they have accountability at the NHL level? We have even no idea of that. We have no idea what their process is, what the NHL can do to check. They're not telling anybody. They don't make it clear that they check. It's just a complete unknown. Again, so this is a system set up where you are guaranteed to have massive cheating. And we are, I think, you know, we can't say for sure, but certainly looks that way to me. Like there's been massive cheating, and there's been massive cheating in other years. Again, I can't say for sure, but that's how this looks, and there's no other way to slice it. And there wasn't, from the moment Stone went out with a lacerated spleen, there was no way to know. And that's what every NHL writer should have said. There is no way to know if they're gaming the system or not. And instead they were kind of snarky about it. Like, oh, well, this, you know, you fans, what do you know? Anyway, so there's that. To fix this, then they've got to fix this. I don't know what they can do with the cap or anything like that. But they at the very least, they've got to have more transparency and more accountability and an open process at the NHL of reviewing this. They should have an investigation right now of Las. The NHL should say, we're having an investigation of this, and we are going to report on it to the fans so they know what's happening here.
Good and luck with that.
They're not going to do that, but. Again, 100% guaranteed cheating, and it's you're almost foolish if you don't, because that's the way the system is set up.
Yeah, well, I've seen folks out there complimenting Kelly McCrimmon there and Vegas for his ruthlessness, and I've even seen people criticizing Ken Holland for never taking advantage of the rules like this. So I'm thinking, well, what's Holland supposed to do? Hire Jeff Galooly to go out and kneecap Draisaitl and put him out for 2 months just before the trade deadline or what? I mean, our team is healthy. It's hard to game LTIR when your team is healthy. So that's worked Edmonton's advantage for much of the season. But now you get to the deadline where Vegas, with their magical new cap space, have gone out and acquired Hanifin and
Hurdle,
and also
Mantha,
the big guy from Washington, Mantha.
Three guys.
They were all in the lineup for him the other night. Now if Stone comes back to the playoffs for game one, just like he did last year, same player did it. You know, it's like they're going to have $90 million team against all the other $80 million teams. And it's getting old.
It is. You know, isn't it?
Chicago did it. Tampa did it. Vegas did it. Looks like Vegas is doing it again. So maybe they just need one Canadian team to try it. And then it'll be Edmonton forfeiting a third round pick to Calgary, and it'll be done with it forever.
It's interesting because it tends to happen with older players, right? Like, because they're all kind of banged up and nursing some chronic injury that they're often playing with anyway. So, you know, in years to come, the Oilers are getting older. Hyman, Nugent Hopkins, Nurse, they're all on long-term contracts. You could see one of them where it would be like, yeah, maybe a couple months off before the playoffs would actually be just what the doctor ordered, so to speak. And it would benefit the Oilers. But you can count on it, Bruce. Just when it's going to benefit the Oilers, it will go away. They'll figure it out. Anyway, it's ridiculous. And they're getting all kinds of scorn, and they deserve it.
It doesn't look good, and it doesn't smell good. I mean, it may be that, you know, they sent Mark Stone off to some monastery in the Himalayas, and there was a laying on of hands, and somehow his...
Hot rocks.
His... his lacerated spleen unlacerated itself. Yeah. I mean, they were saying that's a 3 to 6 month injury. Well, I got news for you. It was less than 2 months ago that he suffered it. He was seen on the golf course last week and on the practice ice today. Non-contact jersey, and maybe he still, you know, comes back for game two instead of game one, but it sure doesn't smell good.
It does not. Bruce, let's leave it there tonight. You got to go write the game grades, and we're going to be back at this tomorrow night. So, alrighty. Thanks for talking tonight, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.